and left behind. Severina frowns. It is not just Lucia's thin smile that is weight for her to carry. For the first time, she notices the deep scars that craze their way up her sister's throat. They are healed, but not pale yet. "You are troubled," Severina says. Lucia doesn't acknowledge the words. She keeps her dark eyes trained on the Emperor. "The Sighted had taken all but one of the mines," Lucia says. "They slaughtered some of the workers, but a good portion of them simply turned, cast off their allegiances and threw their lot in with traitors and fools." Severina's stomach turns at the idea of it. "They will find no peace," she says, "not even in death." Lucia nods. "And we did grant them their deaths, every one of them." "Good." "We fought for days inside those mines," Lucia says. "But we could not root them out. They collapsed tunnels on us, buried whole squads and platoons in ice." "How did you answer that?" Severina asks. "We buried them in return," Lucia says. "We turned the mines into mass graves." She shifts, rubbing her left arm absently as if it pains her. "It wasn't just the enemy that we buried," she says. "It was our own, too. The ones who were cut off, or trapped, or just too deep into the mines. It was necessary, but it caused outcry and disorder, disobedience. I was with Commissar Morbin when they turned on him." Severina looks at her sister. The cold air seems unwilling to fill her lungs. "The Cavrone defied orders," Severina says, softly. "They attacked him." "And me," Lucia says. "What did you do?" Lucia looks sidelong at her. "What should be done in such a case?" she asks. Severina doesn't have to think this time. "Every dissident must be shot. Every weakness ended." Lucia nods. "That is what I did. Morbin and I shot every one of them, though we both got cut badly for it. When it was over, I thought Morbin dead, but he kept breathing long enough for us to get back to High Command. Long enough to graduate me to full officer." "Then what?" Lucia blinks. "Then he died," she says simply. "It is to be expected, from so many cuts." Severina doesn't say that she is sorry, because you do not apologize for death. Instead, she bows her head. "Emperor keep him," she says. It feels a long time before Lucia finishes the words. "Once and always," she says eventually. Even with the story told, that heaviness remains in Lucia's face and her posture. She doesn't turn to leave. She just stands there, looking up at the Emperor's golden eyes. "It is more than Morbin's death that troubles you," Severina says. Lucia is still for several ticks of the timepiece. Then she nods, mouths the word yes in silence. "Tell me," Severina says. "Please." Lucia looks at her then, properly, then grabs her and draws her into an embrace. The last time they held each other in such a way was the day their mother died. "Change," she whispers in Severina's ear. "That is what troubles me. The Crusade is not as it was, nor are the Bale Stars. It is no longer about duty or honour. It is about ambition and greed. It is broken, sister. Faith has been broken." Severina breaks free of her sister's grasp. Her mind rings like the muster alarms, and her heart is beating loudly in her ears. "Don't say that," Severina says. She is shaking. Shaken. "Don't say those vile things. Not you. Not ever again." Lucia covers her mouth with her hand. She blinks once. Twice. Then her dark eyes clear, and her hand falls away. She bows her head. "Forgive me," Lucia says. "It is virtue. Morbin. The Cavrone. I allowed it to unsettle me." "Then they were just empty words," Severina says. It would read like a question, but she doesn't mean it as one, and Lucia knows that too. She nods. Just empty words, she says. And nothing more. Chapter 7. A Matter of Loyalty. While the rest of the forward operating camp sleeps, or trains, or heals wounds, the landing fields are awake and active, moving materiel and souls. Bulk landers lift off and touch down, their engines burning like new stars. Heavy lifters move to and fro, soldiers shout and gesture. The place is floodlit to ward off the night, but there are still shadows to step into, if you know how. And there's nothing Andron Fell knows like shadows. He watches through a set of magnoculars from the top of her eyes as the Cavroon soldiers patrol the largest of the landing bays, the one that Kral and Brant spoke about. It is a massive open square that's been panelled flat and surrounded by temporary storage hangars that can be collapsed with ease when the Crusade front moves on. In the middle of the square sits a bulk lander with its ramp down. Figures move up and down that ramp, loading materiel, just like Kral said. Fell can't tell exactly what, from this distance, but he can see the size of some of those containers. It looks like more than just guns, but he won't know without getting closer, which is exactly what he's working out how to do. Around the edge of the landing field there is a high, double-thick wall that looks to be easily twice his height. It's definitely scalable, especially given that he's without his heavy carapace and his gun. He is unmarked in all ways, wearing plain fatigues, gloves, and a cloth mask that hides everything but his eyes, just in case. There are two direct entry routes, both large gates, wide enough to take a tank. One to bring supplies in at the front, one at the back to send them out again. The one at the front, closest to Fell, is guarded by two Cavroon sentries. It would follow that the other gate is the same. Then there are the roving patrols. The Cavroon move from floodlight to floodlight in pairs with overlapping routes. They are armed with rifles, and wear their raincloak hoods up against the weather. That's one thing that helps him. The noise of the storm is loud anyway, and inside a hood like that, it will be like vox distortion in their ears. Added to the rest of the racket of the place, it will more than cover any kind of noise he might make. Fell watches for another couple of minutes, memorizing the routes the Cavroon take. The overlap of their patrols means that any disruption in the pattern would be noticed within 2 minutes. It's not long, but it could be worse. Fell takes note of the Cavroon themselves, too. He picks out the tired ones from their pace, and the way they shift from foot to foot when they stop. His best option is to wait for those Cavroon who are the most tired and distracted, and to let them pass before going over the wall in the darkest space between the floodlights. He'd come down on the other side, behind one of those storage hangars. Minimal risk of contact. If he has to drop anyone to get away unnoticed, he'd rather do it on egress. Fell's best option comes back around. It's the two Cavroon who are slouching. One of them is smoking a low stick as he walks. Fell stows the magnoculars and moves down the rise as they walk their route, marked by that coil of blue smoke. He sticks to the shadows as he moves towards the landing field, and everything goes out of view but the fence and the floodlights, and the distant dark shape of the bulk lander over the top of them. The ground between the landing field and the rest of the camp is open, but it isn't flat. They only collapsed the parts they needed, so there's enough rubble and broken stone to keep him hidden until he's close enough to make the wall. It's just about knowing when to go still. When he gets close enough, Fell can hear the Cavroon talking as they come to a stop under one of the floodlights.
I wish I were being shipped out with those boxes,
the one with the low stick says.
Another day in that city will kill me.
The other shakes his head.
If you don't stop with that griping, I'll kill you myself.
Low stick laughs.
Go ahead, he says. It'd be a damn mercy. Spare me from walking around here for the rest of the night.
He looks up at the fence and blows smoke.
I don't see the need, he says. For the sake of some munitions and whatever else it is they're moving. The supplies aren't even ours.
The other Cavroon growls.
Thought I told you to stop griping, he says. We guard it. like the General ordered us. You know how it goes if you question Sylar. You heard what happened to Halivar and the others.
Lowstick's shoulders slump.
Yeah, I heard,
he says, with some cold in his voice. The two of them get to walking again. Fel waits for the distance to make the stab lights on their lasguns go dim, and their voices a murmur, then makes for the spot at the wall where the shadows are deepest. He crosses the open ground at a run, putting his momentum into a jump right at the wall to propel himself up it. It hurts, with the stitches in his arms and the weakness in his leg where he was shot, but both of his hands hit the top, and he pulls himself up and over, then drops to the ground on the other side. He crosses straight to the back of one of the storage buildings, straight into the shadows. He goes still, and waits a moment, listening for noise from the other side of the wall. Fel hears nothing but the rain, the wind, the sound of the landing field activity. No vox chatter, no shouting, no contact. Lydia Zane sits cross-legged on the floor of her tent and tries to meditate, to calm the storm of her mind and send the bird away. No, the birds. She opens her eyes slowly and lets out the breath she has been holding. It steams in the cold. Around her, objects turn lazily in the air. A handful of glass beads, a straw doll, a tattered old pict, several shining rounds of ammunition. Beyond them, the birds sit and watch. One black, one white, both utterly still. She ignores them. Zane hums as she sends the objects spinning. The temperature drops another couple of degrees. Frost begins to form around her feet. The song is one that Zane's mother would sing to her when she was just a child, when her gifts were still hidden and her hands were unbloodied. Zane usually finds calm in the song when all else fails. But not today. She cannot rid herself of Kalvar Larat's mocking words. Freedom, just for a moment. That is my last truth, my last gift to you. Freedom. It is a violent gift, and she had reveled in it as she killed him. A moment unwatched, unjudged. But then she thinks that perhaps that was not the freedom he meant after all. That he was speaking of the death he showed her. Her death. Painful, agonizing, but oh so quiet. Those four birds against a bright blue sky. Four. Not two. So there is still time yet. The glass beads clatter together, and one cracks. Flakes of old straw splinter from the doll's arms and legs. The wounds on Zane's own arms ache and sting in sympathy. She hums her song louder, but the pain grows worse and not better, and Zane realizes that it is not just because of Kalvar Larat, nor is it because of the birds, that there is another reason that her mind cannot grow calm, despite the song. It is the long shadow, the one from the forges. She can still feel it, here on Laxus Secundus. Shapeless, deep, dark, without name. No. Is it? There is a noise outside Zane's tent that disrupts her thoughts, and then her mind does calm. The objects drop out of the air around her, hitting the floor of the tent in sequence. Zane gets to her feet and steps out of the circle of scattered earth that she made for herself. She ducks out of her tent, her staff in hand, and finds herself looking at four figures. Three of them are soldiers, wearing black and silver carapace plate. Their helms are enclosed with round green eye lenses. The fourth figure is unmasked. He wears a dark uniform with no marks on it that she recognizes. He is not Antari. He has not the height or the lean weight, and his eyes are blue, like winter ice. He should not be here, not unescorted.
You are Lydia Zane, the uniformed man says instead. Primaris Psyche, Antari Rifles.
Something about him makes her want to scream, her skin crawls. Not one of the soldiers moves, They just stand there, rain-slick and still, their faces hidden behind their masks, and their glowing eyes locked on her.
"Aye," she says. "Who is asking?"
"Requisitions officer, Andol Toller," he says with a bow, "on behalf of High Command."
Zane cannot tell if he lies, and that frightens her. Her mind is not just calm now. It is silent. Blind. That sickness and panic grows worse by the moment.
"You are soul blind," she says. "A blank."
Toller's face stays careful, neutral. He does not acknowledge her words.
"We have come here to collect you," Toller says. "You are being reassigned."
Zane takes a step backwards. It does not feel like a reassignment. It feels like a snare. Blind the animal, trap it, use it. She is suddenly very aware of the distance between her tent and those of the rest of her regiment. The witch circle that makes them feel safe, that now serves against her. She is aware of her fragility, without her gifts, of the ache in her bones and the guns carried by those silent soldiers.
"Reassigned to what?" she asks. "To where?"
Toller shakes his head.
"Classified, I'm afraid."
"If you cannot tell me, then I cannot go,"
Zane says. Toller narrows his ice-blue eyes.
"It is not optional," he says. "It is an order."
"Not unless it comes directly from my superiors," she says, keeping her voice level.
"High Command are your superiors, which makes me your superior also," Toller says. "But if you insist."
He produces a data slate from the pocket of his dress coat. On it is Lydia Zane's name and her assigned code, given to her at the Scholastica Psychana, along with many other things. The bindings, inside and out. She blinks rain from her eyes and stares at the screen, at the words that glow red like a harmful thing, like something that can poison. Approved for reassignment. Nowhere does she see a signature, facsimile or otherwise, from any of her regimental commanders. And then there is the matter of Toller himself. They would not send a blank after her, unless they were expecting conflict, or to have to take her by force. Toller's presence is a threat, and Lydia Zane does not like to be threatened.
"Your slate changes nothing," she says. "Return here with Captain Hale or General Keane, and have them explain it themselves. Until I have word from my own, I go nowhere."
The smile that flickers across Toller's face is ugly.
"Your own," he says. "It is strange that you think of them that way, when they don't extend you the same courtesy. They fear you, hate you. You owe them nothing."
Zane knows that her kin fear her, hate her, but she knows them and the way of their hate. This man she does not know, and she cannot know, because he is soul blind, because he has been sent to disarm her with three soldiers at his back.
"Word from my own," she says again. "Until then, I have nothing more to say to you."
Toller scowls.
"You are an asset, like a gun or a tank, nothing more. Neither of those things question their reassignment or use, and neither will you."
He snaps his fingers, and the three soldiers in carapace step forwards with their guns raised.
"And like any other asset,"
he says, with that ugly smile still in place,
"if we have to dismantle you to move you, then so be it."
Davin Wick is halfway back from the tanker's lot when he hears raised voices carrying on the wind. That's not strange to hear around the encampment, especially for the night before a deployment. It's hard for anyone among them to wait until morning to fight. What's strange is the fact that he's not in the encampment yet. He is in the empty, rubble-strewn land between the tanker's lot and the tent fields, not far from the edge of the witch's circle that separates Lydia Zane's tent from everybody else's. Another cry carries to him, and this time Wick is certain that the voice belongs to Zane. He frowns. The witch is always murmuring, whispering, speaking in her damned riddles. But she doesn't shout. Not like that. That means something is wrong. And the idea of all the things that could be wrong when it comes to her sends his bones cold. Wick wants to keep walking back to camp, to pretend he's not heard it, and leave the witch for someone else to deal with. Preferably the commissar with a bolt round. Maybe they could kill each other in the bargain, and then he'd be free of both of them, and the way they look at him like they know what he is. But he doesn't keep walking. Can't take another step.
No good, he says to himself. That's no good.
If something is wrong, then Zane could kill the lot of them the way she killed that traitor witch. Turned into meat and blood and nothing more. It's no fate at all to die that way. He can't let it happen, not to his kin. So he turns on his heel and chases the noise, pulls his knife, and one of those injectors he took from Colat. It's just in case, he thinks to himself as he punches the needle clean through his fatigues into the meat of his arm. Just in case I have to kill her. Fel moves down the side of the storage hangar, keeping to the shadows cast by the buildings and the equipment stacked between them. Through the space between this hangar and the next, he can see clear out into the landing field, where the material is being moved. Fel can only see Cavron troops moving to and from the lander. No Munitorum in their coveralls, no logisticians or adepts, just soldiers. It's another strange thing in a series of strange things. The Crusade runs on routines, repetition. There's an order to all things, top to bottom, from Chris's fight club to the reassignment of regiments. All things have their rules and their reasons. But this is in breach of most of the ones he knows. And then there is the matter of Caspar Sylar. The Cavron general is standing by the bulk lander, cast in half shadow by the hard light from inside. He is watching his soldiers load up the crates and containers. His continued presence means he sanctioned what they are doing. That they are sending guns, and whatever else is in those containers, to a dead regiment. On his orders. If all of that is true, and Sylar knows it, then that makes him complicit in the misuse of assets, and of providing misinformation to High Command. The idea of that sits very poorly with Andron Fell. He has to get back to Rain to tell her what he has seen, but he won't do that without one last thing. He needs to look at the crates themselves, to know for sure whether they are really being sent to the Strixian 99th. As much as he'd like to trust Laurie Gale's eyes, he trusts his own more. The storage hangars are all built to template, with sliding steel doors at the front, like an aircraft hangar, but there are also smaller, single-access doors on the sides. The one Fel comes to is locked, but it doesn't take much to break the mechanism. It's just a case of knowing where to apply pressure. Inside, the hangar is lit by unstable strip lumens that make the shadows dance. He can hear the Cavron moving around at the top of the hangar, but they won't see him behind the stacks of containers. Whatever they are moving is big. Each container is at least 5 meters deep and twice as long, like caskets for giants. They are also disruptor-fielded. Fel can feel the hum of it in the air. It makes his teeth ache in his head. He drops to a crouch to get a better look at one of the containers. They are plasteel, and unmarked in all ways save for one. There's no insignia, no wear and tear. The only marking on the containers are the serial codes stamped on them, and the silver inlays glimmering in the metal. The patterns of it remind Fel of Devry's tattoos. That unease he feels grows worse, dizzying. For the first time in a long time, Fel feels the urge to turn and run. He has to shake his head to clear it and choose to slow his breathing. He has to put his hand down to stop himself from falling against the containers. And then he hears footsteps at his back and the whine of a Lasgun power pack on the charge. Hells, Fel thinks. Stand up slow, or I drop you. The voice is male, the accent Cavron. There's a waver in the voice that suggests that the speaker is wary, nervous even. Fel gets to his feet and raises his hands so that the Caverone can see he isn't armed. Not with a gun, anyway.
This area is off-limits, the Caverone says. But then you broke a lock to get in here, so I think you know that.
Fel says nothing. He won't give the Caverone his voice. Instead, he looks at how the stab light mounted on the Caverone's gun is casting against the containers, and works out how far away he is. Arm's reach, surely. From the level of it, Fel would guess he's got height on the Caverone, too. And he would also guess that he's quicker, at a push.
Now turn around, the Caverone says. Go for that knife you carry, and I'll shoot at your throat.
Fel does as he's told. He turns around, and he doesn't go for his knife. Instead, he lunges for the Caverone and grabs the rifle before it can go off, twisting it clear of the Caverone's hands. He hears one of the soldier's wrists go with the force of it. He drives the butt of the rifle into the Caverone's face and sends him reeling. Before he can recover, Fel gets him in a chokehold until he goes still. Unconscious and bloody, but not dead. Just like with the door, it's a case of knowing where to apply pressure. Fel drags the Caverone into the shadows between two of the containers, leaving him sat upright so he won't suffocate before he comes to. As well as the rifle, the Caverone has a knife. Fel throws both of them among the containers at the back of the hangar, so that he'll have to look for them. Last of all, he takes the order script the Caverone is carrying. It's a neat roll of parchment, with a list of serial codes stamped on it. One of them matches the container he checked earlier. Right at the bottom, there's a dispatch order, and an icon that Fel doesn't recognize. A hunting bird in white, wings spread against a circle of flame. For immediate and secure redeployment to the Strixian 99th Regiment, the order says. Underneath it, there are words printed that make him go cold. Handle with care, it says. Cargo is live. Lydia Zane sees the rain-soaked ground through half-lidded, bleary eyes as one of the unmarked soldiers pulls her to her feet, holding her arm so that she cannot fight him. They took her Darkwood staff when she tried to crack their heads open with it, and they have disabled and removed her locator collar. The soldier lifts her with such ease, as if her bones are hollow, just like those of her birds. She cannot see them, because Tolla has taken them from her along with her gifts. For the first time, Zane longs to see those birds and their watchful black eyes. She longs to break Tolla and his toy soldiers like she did Kalvar Larratt.
You will see, Tolla says. You are wasted among your so-called kin. We will put your gifts to use for the crusade, for the Emperor.
With considerable effort, Zane lifts her head and spits at him. Tolla raises his fist and strikes her, and the world turns again, dazzling.
Let's go, Tolla says.
And where are you going exactly?
The voice startles Zane. She manages to lift her head again to see Davin Wick standing there. He must have been far from the encampment to hear the trouble and come running, given the witch circle of open space between Zane's own tent and the others. Wick is rain-soaked and smiling, holding his combat knife in a loose grip. Of all of her kinfolk, he is the last she would have asked for. The one who has thought often about whether he would be able to kill her given the chance. She would not put it past him to try it either, if he thought he could do it. She knows that he has done worse over less. Tolla looks at Wick's fatigues and his mark of rank.
Above your clearance, I'm afraid, Sergeant.
The two soldiers, either side of the one holding Zane in place, raise their rifles and point them at Wick. It doesn't seem to bother him. He nods, still smiling. It should be handsome on a face like his, but it just looks jagged, like the edge of something broken.
Oh, you have me wrong, Wick says. You'll have no trouble from me.
His eyes are dark as the night around them, the black of his pupils flooding over the grey. Zane can see how he breathes rapid and shallow, and realizes that even now, after the day's fighting is done, he is still poisoning himself with those stims he takes. One of his ugly secrets.
You can kill her for all I care, Wick says, with that smile still in place.
Bastard, Zane hisses.
See now, he says, and you wonder why I'll be glad to see the back of you. He looks at her, and there is something more than just cruelty in those flooded eyes of his. Wick takes another step forward, closing the distance between them.
Even if you are my kin, Wick says.
Zane flinches. Kin, he said. Kin.
Whether or not trouble was your intent, you have already caused it, Toller says. For yourself, at any rate.
He raises his hand, and around Zane the toy soldiers move.
Kill him, Toller says.
With Collat Stim's boiling Wick's blood, the armored soldiers seem to move slowly, as if through water. Big, obvious movements, glints from their guns as rain hits the metal. The rain is slow too, much slower than his heart as he lunges forwards to close the distance before either of those unmarked soldiers can shoot him. The one in the dress uniform hasn't even drawn his pistol yet.
Stupid. Slow.
Wick jumps into the first soldier and puts him on his back. His knife goes into the soft joint at the soldier's neck, straight through. He feels something go inside, and the soldier thrashes and shakes and spasms. Wick puts the knife in him twice more before he dies, through the soft joints. Then he blinks the blood from his eyes and moves for the other one. The soldier doesn't flinch or step backwards. Brave, or just stupid too. The soldier fires his rifle, and Wick drops into a slide so that the shot grazes his shoulder instead of dropping him. His knife hand goes numb from it, but he doesn't let go. The soldier twists to follow him and fire again, and Wick cuts through the backs of both of his knees where there's no armor. The soldier cries out and goes down heavy, losing his gun. A kick to the second soldier's head while they are both on the ground makes him go as still as the first. Wick gets to his feet.
Enough!
The uniformed man's voice is slow, just like the rain and the way everyone moves. He is pointing a pistol at Zane. The Psyker is dribbling blood because she fought them. For a second, it's almost enough to make Wick want to like her.
I will kill her,
he says, in his slow voice. Wick laughs so hard it hurts his throat.
Do it then, he says.
He doesn't do it. Of course he doesn't. You don't kill what you came for. Instead, he hesitates, frowns, and then falls over backwards with Wick's thrown knife buried in the middle of his chest. A good throw, heart level, into the hilt. The minute the uniformed man hits the earth, something in the air changes. The temperature drops like a stone, and Wick finds he can't move because of the pressure that's coming from Lydia Zane. The pressure that breaks every one of the last soldier's bones before he can even scream. He folds like parchment paper, and finally lets go of Zane. It's the only thing that seems to happen faster than Wick's heart can beat. Then Zane falls forwards, and the pressure lets up, and the night falls silent, save for the rain and the way his heart thunders like a storm of its own. Wick looks down at his hands, at the body of the soldier at his feet. Black armor, trimmed with silver. Twin-headed eagles. Rain and blood all falling and running and dripping. Drip, drip, drip. He starts to laugh again without meaning to. It bubbles up like blood out of a deep cut. The dream the witch gave him was true. Just not the way he thought. It's not his own he killed. Not this time.
Why did you do that?
Zane asks him, snapping him out of his thoughts.
Come here, to help me.
Her voice is a rasp that's hard to pick up over the storm. Wick crosses over to her, stopping out of her arm's reach. He won't get closer than that to a witch. Zane looks like a drowned thing, all pale and bruised with those false flat eyes.
I didn't, he says. I came here because I figured you had lost it, that I would have to kill you.
Zane looks up at him, her face blue pale and streaked with rain.
You could try, she says.
Then she starts laughing,
It's like a cough, or something wounded trying to die. It unsettles Wick so badly that he takes a step backwards without intending to. She gets to her feet and puts out her arm, pulling her splintered staff through the air towards her. It lands in her palm with a snap. Wick walks over to where the uniformed man is lying with his eyes open, fixed on the night sky.
"What was he?" he asks. "What did they do to you to catch you like that?"
"His name was Andal Toller," Zane says. "And he was a Sorblind, a blank."
Wick doesn't know whether that distresses him more or less than the idea of a witch. Cursed is one thing, but to be without a soul is something else entirely.
"They must have wanted you badly," he says, "to kill for it."
"They wanted my gifts, whether I would give them or not."
Zane frowns.
"That last one to die, his mind was full of empty spaces, as if he had been made to forget."
Wick can feel his headache coming back before time.
"Did you find anything else in his head?" he asks her.
"Shapes," Zane says. "Sounds and sights and smells. Cold like midwinter. The song of machines. Needles being pushed into skin."
Her frown grows deeper.
"The smell of fire. And the touch of silent wings."
Her cable crown is humming loud as she remembers. Wick can hear it over the rain.
"So, nothing useful," he says with a shake of his head.
"Toller said that he was sent on behalf of High Command," Zane says, "and now they are dead."
Wick puts his foot on Toller's chest to get purchase enough to pull his knife out, then wipes the blade clean on his fatigues. There's not a patch on them that isn't dark with mud or blood. Camouflage for camouflage.
"They shot first," he says. "Or they tried to, anyway."
"That might be true, but we cannot report it," Zane says. "The Commissar would have us for dead."
Wick nods. His heart is still hammering, but the want to laugh is wearing off. He can feel the cold of the rain and the wind, the burn of the las wound in his shoulder, the old familiar dread that comes with the idea of being found out.
"What do we do now?"
Zane asks. Wick looks around at the four dead men who are rain slick and still. He looks at the collapsed Habs and Manufactoria, and the deep darknesses exposed by shelling.
"We hide them," he says. "And we make a secret of it."
Rain meets with Andren Fell with 2 hours to go until dawn. The storm has turned soft, the rain to mist, like fret blown from an angry ocean. They meet in what was once the palace of the Forge Fathers. It would have been grand once. Great iron and brass cogwheels line the atrium on either side of Rain, supporting the domed ceiling far above. The ceiling had been leaded crystal before, stained with angular depictions of the god-killers built in Laxus Secundus's forges. Now Rain crunches a world's legends under her boots as she walks to where Fell waits for her, at the foot of the stairs to the palace proper.
"You have been gone a long time," she says. "I take it you turned up more than just idle talk."
Fell nods. He sits down on the stairs, and Rain sits beside him. The stairs are marble, inlaid with hexagramic patterns that have been splintered and shattered. It's not the first time that they have met here, on these steps under a night sky. They did the same on the night before the primary forge, too. Just to talk, like they always do. To share stories. Those meetings are a habit that Rain knows that she should not have, just as much as she knows she cannot give them up.
"It is as you said," Fell says. "Things are changing."
Fell is turning a parchment screed in his gloved hands. His restlessness makes Rain uneasy, because he is not the type to act like that. Not unless something is really troubling him.
"And I don't think it is just the sighted," Fell says.
He holds out the parchment, and she takes it. It is speckled by rain, but otherwise undamaged. She unrolls the parchment and looks at it as he explains to her what he learned and what he saw, first from the Antari and the logisticians, then from the landing fields. "The Strixian 99th, Rain says when he stops talking. "They are dead." Fel nods. "On Hicks, I know." Rain frowns and shakes her head. The name means something to her, because she doesn't forget the dead.
"No, not Hicks. It was the Chorus Belt, I'm sure of it. A whole flotilla, shot to scrap."
Fel goes still when she says those words.
"Regiments have been rebuilt in the past," he says, "forged together from broken parts to die again."
"That is true," she says, "but I don't think that is the case here, do you?"
"No," he says, "I don't."
Rain looks at the parchment in her hands, at the words printed in red.
"Cargo is live," she says.
"Live or not, whatever the Cavrone were moving cannot be good," Fel says. "It felt like submersion, just standing beside those containers, like being held under with no light to see the surface."
He is flexing his fingers as if they hurt him, as if what he is trying to say hurts him too.
"One of them got the drop on me," he says. "I didn't hear a thing until he was close. I should have, but there was something about that place and those containers."
"Did he see anything to know you by?" Rain asks.
Fel shakes his head.
"He won't forget in a hurry, though. I had to hurt him pretty badly."
"That sits poorly with you," Rain says. He nods.
"Until I know what they have done, if they have broken faith."
"We will find out," Rain says, "and then we will drag it all out into the light so that it is plain to see. If faith has been broken, then those guilty of it will be broken in turn."
"Including Sylar?" Fel asks.
Rain nods.
"Including Sylar."
"What could be worth it?" Fel says. "Worth breaking faith over?"
Rain thinks about what she has heard about Caspar Sylar, about how his cruelty is only outstripped by his ambition.
"Power," she says. "Glory, the stars, and everything in between them."
"Said that way, it sounds like something from the old stories," Fel says. "Like the King of Winter."
Rain rolls the parchment neatly and starts to turn it in her own hands.
"Our next posting is to fight alongside the Cavrone," she says. "High Commander sending us to the primary city."
"Seems like fate's work," Fel says.
"Or something like it," Rain says.
She puts the roll of parchment into her inside pocket and gets to her feet, suddenly unable to sit still.
"It is because of Sylar, because of the Cavrone, because they were Lucia's regiment before.
And that really does feel like fate's work." She thinks of Lucia's words in the chapel that day, so long ago, and the fear in her sister's eyes as she spoke about change and ambition. For a moment, Rain wonders if Lucia could have seen this corruption taking root and earned her death by trying to stop it. That thought stirs a dangerous hope inside her, long extinguished. One that she should ignore or smother. One that she should know better than to heed. Rain puts her hand in her pocket, and her fingertips brush against the timepiece. She has put the data crystal back inside, and bent back the casing to hide it again until she finds a way to unlock it. It feels heavier now than it ever has, that timepiece. Heavy and cold. It is a lot to carry, alone. She looks at Fel, sitting there on the step under the mist of rain that comes in through the shattered ceiling.
"Do you trust me?" she asks. "With my life," he says, without even a pause.
"Despite what I am," Rain says.
Fel gets to his feet now, too.
"Because of what you are," he says.
"And what is that to you?"
Rain asks him. He stands there, unarmed and unarmored, without his pins or his colours. For a moment, they are both just souls.
"Strong,"
he says. In all of the ways that it matters. Rain thinks that she should know what to say to him then, but she cannot find the words. It is a strange feeling, to not know. Ill-fitting, like clothes made too large.
Something is troubling you, Fel says. Something more than the Cavrone, or the guns, or the sighted.
She wants to take the timepiece out of her pocket and explain it to him, all of it. Her father, and his coward's blood. Her mother, a dead hero. Her sister, the traitor. But Rain cannot make her hand close around the timepiece, and she cannot find those words either. It takes her a moment to recognize the feeling. Fear. She is afraid of seeing that look on Fell's face that she saw on the faces of those at the commissariat conclave and the Skolarm before it. She is afraid that once he knows about the failings of her blood, he will not trust her any more. He said that she was strong in all the ways that matter, but in this, Rain finds that she cannot be. Not yet.
We need to return to camp, she says instead. It is a story for another time.
He smiles, just barely, and nods.
Another time, then, he says.
Davin Wick stands halfway down the steps of a ruined habitation block, looking into the deep, dark water that has flooded the Hab's lower levels. It looks black, like the lakes of the Vales. The Hab block is part of the collapsed cityscape, out in nowhere between the Antari encampment and the tanker's lot. It's a place that nobody would care go to until the Crusade Front moves on, which makes it good for hiding things. Like bodies. All of that black water swallows up the dead Blank and his soldiers with ease, and as Wick watches them go, he thinks about the water wraiths, and wonders if they take those who are dead already, or if they just like to drown the living. He wonders if Raff found one all that time ago, down there in the dark.
Someone will know, Zane says. The Blank and his men will be expected, or missed by those that sent them, and then they will come for us.
The witch is sitting next to him on the step, watching the water lap against the stone.
Not for me, Wick says with a shrug. For you, maybe.
What was done was both of ours, Zane snaps. Your hands are as bloody as mine.
Bloodier. The word surfaces in his head, like a bloated thing breaching the skin of a lake.
So that is it, she says bitterly. We make a secret of it.
Unless you want to die, he says,
then turns to go up to the surface and back to the forward camp. Zane doesn't move from the spot. She just keeps watching the water. Wick is careful to keep half an eye on her as he goes, because of what she is.
You have so many secrets, she says. It is a wonder there is room inside you for another.
Wick stops on the step. His knife is in his hand, though he can't remember drawing it.
Get out of my head, he says, but I'll put you in that water too.
Zane gets to her feet, leaning on her staff to do it. She finally turns away from the black water.
I am not in your head, she says. I do not need to be. Your mind sings loudly, especially when that poison you take is burning your blood.
Zane has known about the Stim since Gull, since they went into the mountains and the moor, and he made the mistake of trying to drag her to her feet to stop them all from dying.
It was touching her that did it. You should never touch a witch. If you say a word about it, he starts to say.
I will not, Zane says, interrupting him. Because I owe you a debt.
Wick scowls. He knows the value of an owing. But he doesn't want that from her kind. It seems more a curse than anything else. Zane tilts her head. It reminds him of a bird, the way she does it.
And because we are kin, she says. That is what you said, back there.
They were just words, Wick says. And they didn't mean a damn thing.
It is the truth, though,
she says,
that we are kin, in more ways than you think.
You're a witch, he says. Save for where we call home, I am nothing like you.
Death, she says. That is what makes us the same.
Wick snorts a laugh.
We all make death. We all know it.
Zane smiles, and it kills the laughter in his chest. Her smile is a cold thing, as if she has only ever watched one happen, and never tried it herself.
You are followed by it, she says, and by what happened on Quarter.
Wick finds himself frozen there on the steps, not by her witch's power, but by her words, and the things that come back to him as she speaks them. Jungle heat, sweat on the walls of the transport and everyone inside, Keller humming.
Shut up,
he says.
You were the only one to walk away when that transport was torn to pieces, she says. Death took a look at you, and it passed you over.
Shut up,
he says the words through his teeth as he remembers what came after. The bloom of light, the noise that he thought had made him deaf until the ringing came back. Blood in his eyes and his nose and his mouth. The heat of the fire as it burned everyone else but him, Keller and Hayne and Dooney and all of the others. He had to write their names in the ash that was made of them, because he was alone and lost, and the tinderbox and the paper had been with Dooney. He never speaks of Quarter, not with Ord or even Lai, not with anyone. But now he finds he can't stop himself because she won't shut up, and he can't make her because if he touches her, she'll take even more from him than she already has.
You talk as though you know of it, but you don't. You couldn't.
How can you be so sure?
She says, with that tilt of her head again.
Mists and moors he wants to hit her. I wrote my name back there, he snarls. I wrote it in the ashes in the list of the dead, because I thought that soon I would be too. But when the sighted came, I kept killing them until my gun went dry and my knife went dull.
You were afraid, Zane says.
I was angry,
he says, though there are times when the two are hard to tell apart.
I wanted to bleed them for what they had done to us, and I did. They cut me back for my trouble, badly.
The scars are such pale lines now, all those years later. Shoulder, collarbone, chest, stomach. That one had been the worst. All of the bloodstains had spread so much they joined up and painted him red.
But you did not die, as you had thought, Zane says. Death passed you over again.
Lai had been the one to find him. Wick hadn't recognized her at first. He'd taken her for sighted too and tried to cut her before she'd knocked him down. Enough, she'd said. That's enough. Then Lai had stuck him with a needle and put him under so he'd stop fighting her. Her lake stone eyes had been the last thing to go when the darkness rolled over.
I kept trying to tell Lai, but she didn't listen, he says, half to himself.
Tell her what? Zane asks.
Wick can see it then, written in ashes under the jungle canopy.
That I hadn't scrubbed out my name, he says. I left it for death, and now it knows me.
Zane nods.
That is what I meant, she says, when I said that we are more kin than you think.
What?
Wick asks. Zane laughs, and it echoes in the hollow space. She goes to leave, turning into no more than a shadow as she goes up the stairs.
Death, she says. It knows me too.
Eli Collett watches Grey Company's witch come up and out of the collapsed tab through a set of grubby magnoculars that paint her in shades of green and make hollows out of her eyes. Collett can't help the face he pulls. He can't abide witches. He waits, though looking at her is turning his stomach. He knows it'd be worse were he closer. She might be able to hear his thoughts, and he can't have that. Can't have her spoil his fun. His payback. Collett sits and waits a bit longer for Wick to follow her out of the darkness. Just like he thought, they were using the place to hide those bodies they were moving. The ones in carapace plate and officers' colours. That's bad. At least for Wick, anyway. Colette has no quarrel with the witch, not that he'd have the heart to do anything about it, even if he did. Wick's the one who damn near broke his leg, stole from him, laughed at him. Wick is the one who thinks himself free of consequence, but he'll learn the hard way once word gets out about these bodies. Colette can't help but grin now either. He slides off the collapsed wall he's sitting on and stows the magnoculars. Then he limps back towards the tanker's lot, whistling softly. A song from home. One called The Hangman's Wish. When she returns to the Antari encampment and her command tent, Rain makes a request for information from the office of Lord Commissar Mardantula for all deployment and materiel requisitions in relation to the Eastward arm of the Baelstars Crusade.
"This will take time," Tula says, over the secure hololith link.
His image flickers, but his gaze is no less discerning for it.
"It is a substantial request."
Rain nods. She asked for everything, because it is the easiest way to hide that you are looking for something in particular. Dragnets always catch more than just their intended quarry. "I understand," she says, "but it is necessary." Tula's eyes narrow.
"I doubt you would ask otherwise," he says.
"I will get you what you need, and send it with Kurtz. The boy is diligent and trustworthy."
There is something in the way Tula says trustworthy that gives Rain pause. "It is a valuable thing, Lord," she says carefully. "Trust?"
"And rare," he says.
Tula's image flickers as thunder rumbles overhead. Rain hears it through the hololith too, a moment later.
"There is a storm coming," he says. "It will make the next days more difficult. Be watchful in the primary city."
At the Skolem, Rain spent long hours trying to read others, to find their weaknesses and their fears, to catch a lie when it is being hidden, or a truth in equal measure.
"Always," she says. "Emperor go with you, Lord."
Tula makes the sign of the Aquila as the hololith crazes and flickers.
"And with you, Commissar Rain," he says.
And then the connection fails and Tula disappears. Rain sits back in her seat.
"He sounded wary," Fel says.
He was quiet while she spoke with Tula, because protocol dictates he should not have been there at all. Given everything she has come to suspect, Rain finds that particular breach doesn't bother her all that much.
"Yes, he did," she says. "And that is troubling in itself."
"Do you trust him?"
Fel asks. If Fel had asked her a week ago, she would have said yes. Now the word won't come, no matter how badly she wants to say it.
"He will get the records," she says. "If nothing else, he is a man of his word."
"Often that is good enough," Fel says.
Rain nods.
"Until we know what we face, this must stay between us," she says.
"I know,"
Fel says.
"It might mean lying to your kin," she says. "To your Duskhounds."
He nods. She sees the way he crosses his hand over one of the tattoos on the inside of his left arm, the shadowy shape of the Duskhound made in ink there, the mark his kin all bear too.
"I won't speak of it. Not to them or anyone. You have my word."
She knows what these choices mean for him, how hard they are to make. Andron Fell is Antari, his identity rooted in the place he was born and made. She is not. Not Antari. Not a soldier. By rights, he should not choose her at all.
"So, what now?"
Fell asks her. She looks at him. He is mud-spattered and soaked with rain. The sleeves of his fatigues are rolled back to the elbow, so Rain can see blood soaking through the bandage from the cut he took in the forges. "Let me look at that," she says. Fel shrugs. "It's not so bad," he says.
"It wasn't a question."
Fel smiles at that, despite everything. That easy smile of his was strange to her at first. Over time, though, she has come to find it a comfort. Rain fetches her medical kit and moves to sit on the edge of the folding table, close enough to look at the damage properly. She cleans her hands with counterseptic, then takes hold of his arm and unwinds the old bandage. The cut is bleeding badly. Too badly just to bind it.
"That story you spoke of earlier," Rain says. "I don't think I know it."
"The King of Winter," Fel says. "I must have told you that one." Rain shakes her head. She takes a clean wad of gauze and holds it in place on his arm with enough pressure to stop the bleeding. She can see where he's taken a dozen other cuts on that arm. Old scars under and over the tattoos he has of scripture and of the wicked creatures from his stories.
"I would remember it if you had," she says with a smile.
He laughs. That was another thing that surprised her to start with, until she realized that he doesn't share that laugh with everyone, just with those he trusts.
"True enough," he says. "The story of the King of Winter is one of Morrow, too."
Rain nods.
"The first and most revered of Antar's saints," she says, as she checks how badly the cut is still bleeding.
Too badly to stitch yet.
"That name I do know."
She knows the look of Morrow, too, because she is the subject of one of Fel's tattoos. Morrow looks strong, the way she has been inked into his skin, with fierce, dark eyes and her pointed fingers held steepled in that Antari gesture for oaths.
"The story is old," Fel says.
His voice has softened the way it does when he tells stories.
"Even for Antar. It goes that when the world was first made, the winters were fierce and long, and it was a king who brought them, one with claws and wings, but that wore the face of a man. Because the emperor, wisest of all, knew that the forests would die if winter did not pass, he made Morrow to balance winter's king. She was a fierce creature, with thorns woven into her hair and a cloak of leaves."
"That is why you call her Our Lady of Thorns," Rain says. Fel nods. Rain takes away that wad of gauze now and sets to cleaning the blood away. Fel doesn't flinch, though she knows it must hurt. That is how he is in all things, unflinching.
"When the time came for winter to pass," Fel says, "Morrow would go to fight the king in the heartwood of Antar's oldest forest. As they fought, the sky would grow fierce with fire and thunder. But after 3 days, Morrow would always emerge triumphant, and the King of Winter would retreat to the mountains where he kept his castle and where winter never passed."
Rain goes back in her medical tin and takes out her suture kit. She sets about stitching that cut closed while he talks.
"Over time, the king grew jealous. The people of Antar loved Morrow because she brought with her flowers and food. They did not love the King of Winter. They spoke his name in whispers and dreaded his coming."
"So what did the king do?" Rain asks.
"He knew that he could not beat Morrow fairly, so he made a deal with the vipers of the earth, that they could have his mountain seat